understand that it is quite difficult for me or for French people to understand that you're voting for European election despite the fact you want to leave.
Oh, it's very difficult for everyone to understand.
Yeah.
We have, let's get this right, we have voted to leave, and yet 3 years on, our government and parliament have failed to deliver, they've broken all their promises, and that's why we're in these elections. And the whole thing's a nonsense.
And so today, you are voting to get to the parliament, but at the same time, you will leave the parliament as soon as possible.
Hopefully the 31st of October. I hope to be the shortest-lived MEP in history.
Okay.
That's the plan.
Brexit Party leader Nigel Farage answering questions from a French journalist today as he cast his vote for the European Parliament. The EU elections just kicked off across Europe. It's a four-day-long affair, and the results could determine, eventually, whether the EU will remain the EU, i.e. a united Europe. The first two countries to vote are the UK and the Netherlands. Jennifer Baker is based in Brussels, where she covers EU policy. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Okay, so you're just outside the European Parliament now, hence the birds. Sounds quite peaceful, but
yes.
But there's a lot of chaos happening right now in this election, right? I mean, describe what could happen if Europe's far-right nationalists win a lot of seats.
Well, that's what we're expecting. We are expecting to see a bit of a swing to the far right. The last time we had European elections was 5 years ago. Things were a little bit more measured then, sort of different times, as it were. Politics has changed a lot in 5 years. Mm-hmm. So what we're expecting to see, a lot of these fringe sort of Eurosceptic parties gain a lot of the votes in possibly in most member states, certainly in sort of the bigger, more obvious sceptical countries. And the question then is whether they will be able to work together in the future on a European Parliament, and that is much less certain. Even if all the predictions come true and there is this big swing to the right, there are certain rules that the European Parliament applies to decide whether you can form a political group. There has to be enough representation from different member states. There are quotas to meet. Now, it's likely that they will meet the quotas. There's already a far-right wing group, if you like, but that group in the past has been plagued by squabbling, as once you get beyond the sort of big issue, you know, we don't like the EU, they break down a lot on a lot of these other smaller issues. And so there is a sort of a tricky balance for those parties to strike, especially as many of them will be coming to the European Union's centre here in Brussels for the first time. And, you know, how these things work, there's a lot of power play, there's a lot of struggles. And if they're not experienced at it, you know, groups do fall apart. They break up, new political groups are formed all the time.
Okay, so that is quite an interesting idea. If you have someone like a Matteo Salvini from Italy working with a Marine Le Pen from France and a Geert Wilders from the Netherlands, what do they agree on besides the fact that they really don't like a united Europe?
Well, I mean, what they don't like on tends to fall to these other sort of far-right areas. They dislike immigration. They say that the EU institutions, as it were, are too lenient on migration, that they sort of object to some of the burden sharing arrangements in taking in migrants. They also, some of them adopt and want to see a more fiscal hands-off approach. They also scaremonger quite a lot about this idea of a European army, but that is genuinely quite scaremongering. No one's really suggested that. But, you know, they can use this sort of rhetoric to whip up very anti-European sentiment.
Well, so let's say they do win a substantial voting bloc and they are able to work together. What would be their first priority when it comes to reshaping EU policy? Would it be cracking down on immigration?
Well, I mean, they're not really, they can't just simply go out and do that. I mean, the way the European Parliament works is that they have to vote on laws that are proposed by the European Commission. Now, since the Lisbon Treaty, they actually do have quite a big say in that. Formerly, the European Parliament was very much just a ceremonial sort of rubber stamping organisation. Now, they have committees and they have leads and they have chairs of these committees and they have what we call a rapporteur, and they go through the process of altering the laws as they've been proposed. And it's a line-by-line, paragraph-by-paragraph job, which is actually very tiresome if all you want to do is think about the big picture. But what they can do is they can hold up what's going on. They can hold up the work of the Parliament. They can frustrate those committees in getting their jobs done by, you know, asking for things to be sent back for second readings. They're asking for bills to be sent back to the legal services for more amendments. You know, so they can actually just disrupt the general working of the European Parliament, which is what it seems likely most of them will seek to do. In terms of things like, you know, countries leaving the EU, which is, as we've seen with Brexit, a big issue, there's no powers within the European Parliament for them to go any way down the road to making that happen. That happens at a national level. And also things like migration. There will be a committee within the European Parliament that will have a say on migration law. But although it will have to approve any new, any new legislation on the matter, or any new agreement or guidelines that we see, it doesn't write that, and it doesn't necessarily set the boundaries of that. And that a lot of that then is back to the European Council, which is made up of the leaders of the member states. So a lot of this is, it's just nipping at the heels of the overall EU institutions. The idea that, you know, right-wing MEPs could bring down the EU. So it's worth noting that they can disrupt things. But whether they'll be able to work together to coherently have a major impact on damaging the EU processes, you would need to have a lot of faith in the abilities of a lot of people who have no experience to think that that may happen.
Well, let's talk about the UK in particular, voting today. And of course, Brexit is looming in the foreground of that vote. Is this seen as another referendum kind of on Brexit?
I mean, absolutely. It'll be read very much as a bellwether for what the people think. It's obviously not a second referendum. That in itself is so contentious. But yes, I think if you do some very crude analytics on it, you will be able to say most people want a Brexit, a hard Brexit, a just get out of Europe, get on with it. And other people want, you know, they want to remain, or they want a second referendum. They want the chance to say we would like to stay in Europe. It's going to be very difficult to actually work out what it means. Let's look at Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn. They don't know what they want. So it's kind of it's a very difficult idea that we could work out from the votes for those people who don't know what they want, what the people who vote for them want.
Yes, it is all very confusing and all mixed up, kind of like a milkshake.
Yeah.
All mixed up like a milkshake. And I refer to that because Nigel Farage was doused by a milkshake earlier this week by, I guess, an anti-Brexiteer. If Nigel Farage wins re-election to the European Parliament, as he said in that clip that we just heard, he doesn't want to fulfill his term, the next 5 years. He wants to be out because he wants Britain to be out.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
I mean, what is he going to do in the meantime? What's his point being there? I mean, if he doesn't believe in the whole concept of it, why run at all? Why be there at all?
Well, I suppose he sees it as a position of high profile. It's a position of power. I mean, you know, he gets to stand up in the European Parliament during the debates and shout at the pro-EU people and you know, grandstand and make his points right in the heart of Europe, which, you know, is a very powerful image. So I mean, obviously, he plays everything with one eye to the domestic audience, if not two eyes to his domestic audience. But, you know, these are the elections he's got to fight. He has famously tried to run for the national elections in the UK something like 8 times and has failed to be elected. So he can win the European election. And I suppose, in a sense, if you're anti the EU, make that noise heard when you're in the European elections and maybe deal with more domestic matters when you're voting in a general election. So it's about the symbolism of it rather than about any practicalities.
Right. So meanwhile, back at home, Theresa May, she's encountering her own difficulties. And I guess she was going to put, or she talked about possibly putting forward a second referendum. That seems to be not in the cards right now. What is in the cards for her?
She said she would allow the MPs to vote on whether there'd be a second referendum. I don't know what time this goes out at tonight, whether she'll actually still be in a job or not. I mean, it's minute by minute with Theresa May at the moment. We're hearing a lot of speculation that she may well announce her resignation tomorrow, Friday morning, because there will be so much speculation that the Tories, her party, will have been crushed in the European elections. I mean, they were, according to some polls and some pundits, they're on track to do the worst they've done in years, in a generation. So, you know, she's presided over this fiasco and no one's happy with her. So she has said she will leave, but she sort of says she also wants to get Brexit done before she goes. The prospect of that seems ever more remote. And I think we're counting Theresa May's tenure in days, not in weeks.
Jennifer Baker is an EU policy journalist based in Brussels. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, the Trump administration is backing off plans to put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. A disappointment for the former administration, for sure. Here is former President Obama's Treasury Secretary Jack Lew talking about it in 2016.
Here, a woman born a slave, illiterate her whole life, can, after spending countless trips going back and forth, freeing people on an individual basis, work for the army to help, you know, as a spy, you know, help them find their way into battle in the Civil War, and then be a founder of the women's suffrage movement, how that can change our country.
Well, Tubman's face would have replaced that of former President Andrew Jackson, who was a slaveholder. He also okayed forcing Native Americans off their land, you know, the Trail of Tears. The redesign was supposed to be unveiled next year, but Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin now says the bills won't be in circulation until after President Trump leaves office, if he wins re-election in 2028. James Homan is national political correspondent for The Washington Post, and he joins us now to talk about this. Hi.
Hi.
Well, what did Mnuchin say about why this wouldn't happen?
Well, his explanation really doesn't pass the smell test. He said that he's focused on trying to make the $10 bill and the $50 bill harder to counterfeit so that he can't move forward with the pre-planned move to redo the $20 bill and unveil something in 2020 to put into circulation. So he says, because of the timeline that's been rearranged, he's not going to be able to, or any Treasury Secretary is not going to be able to get to the $20 bill now until as early as 2028. And he very kind of deliberately, carefully recognizes the terrible optics of saying we're not going to put Harriet Tubman on the bill. So he was trying to come up with some kind of procedural reasons that when you look at them really don't add up for why they can't move forward with this plan that was already now announced 3 full years ago.
Well, by optics, what do you mean?
It looks terrible. You know, this is the it looks terrible to say we're no longer going to put the first woman on a major piece of currency in a century. We're not going to put an African-American woman on the currency. This is kind of a stark illustration of Obama's legacy being rolled back piecemeal, whether it's the Iran deal or the healthcare law or environmental regulations and the Paris peace or the Paris climate treaty. This is kind of a very big symbolic move by Trump, and they don't want to have a big fight about race in America or gender. And so they're trying to make it sound like it's kind of not a big deliberate decision, but just something that happened by default, which is not the case. This is them deciding, you know, the president has kind of come to revere, even emulate Andrew Jackson in some ways. He has a big portrait of Andrew Jackson hanging in the Oval Office. He made a pilgrimage to Andrew Jackson's home outside of Nashville. And the president doesn't want Andrew Jackson to be replaced. And that's what's really going on here. And he certainly doesn't want him to be replaced by Harriet Tubman. And he said as much as a presidential candidate in early 2016 when Jack Lew, who we just heard from, Obama's Treasury Secretary, made the initial announcement.
Yeah, he said basically Tubman shouldn't grace a $20 bill. She should maybe be on a $2 bill.
Yeah, that's what he said.
Yeah. Okay, well, if this is an issue of great symbolism for him, I mean, you'd think he'd want to trumpet it and say, okay, I'm owning this. This is symbolically important. It's a symbol of my presidency. I don't want a black woman on the currency. I want Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point he just went ahead and said that, right? He often goes farther than some of his aides. I think, you know, that was Steven Mnuchin yesterday before the House Financial Services Committee. And the thing is, we've been asking the Treasury Department for 2 years now, and so have senators and congressmen. Are you going to do this? Are you going to follow through? The big announcement, the big reveal was supposed to come next year on the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage by constitutional amendment. And they've stonewalled. They haven't answered our questions or questions from Congress. And so this was Mnuchin under oath trying to defend his budget request and being pressed quite hard on the Hill. So this wasn't something that the Treasury Department wanted to announce. This isn't something that Mnuchin wants to define his legacy. But my hunch is that at some point it will come up. In some ways, this president has been happy to have fights over monuments. Whether it's Robert E. Lee Monument after Charlottesville or other monument fights that have come up. And then when you think about it, money, for better or worse, and in some ways it's unfortunate, but money's the most important monument that we have as a country because we carry it around in our pocket every day. And it is an explicit statement of who the country celebrates in an implicit statement of what the country values. And so the decision not to put Harriet Tubman on the 20 is a statement of values and priorities, and it signals something. And I think that that's more important than whatever explanation the administration gives for doing it or not doing it.
Yeah. Well, I know. And it's also ironic because, as you point out in your article, Andrew Jackson really opposed a federal central bank. He didn't believe.
I'm glad you know. I had sort of forgotten that. And yeah, it is actually incredibly ironic. If you study the 19th century at all and you kind of know how, you know, the defining, we talk about Donald Trump and the border wall, build the wall, build the wall. That's kind of the defining issue of the Trump presidency. The defining issue of the Andrew Jackson presidency was there should not be a central bank printing money. So it is an irony of history that he's on our $20 bill.
So maybe he would say, if he could come back, he would say, look, get me off this bill, put Harriet Tubman on it. I don't want anything to
right.
do with it.
Well, it's sort of funny. You have a lot of people who are saying, well, you know, the best thing to troll Trump now if he loses in 2020 is for the next Democratic president to say, we're going to put Barack Obama on the $20 bill instead of Harriet Tubman. I don't think that's going to happen. But yeah, I mean, this is the president cares about this kind of thing. I mean, this is the guy who has Time magazine covers hanging up of himself everywhere, and you know, in his office and at his clubs. And so he recognizes the power of imagery. And he also, in many ways, his presidency is a reactionary presidency. It's about going back. There was some new polling today that showed, you know, a lot of his supporters overwhelmingly feel like the United States was a better country in the 1950s than it is today. And a lot of people who oppose the president feel the opposite.
James Holman, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Coming up, disability rights advocates are just furious that wealthy parents allegedly game the system to get their kids more time to take college admissions tests. How that scandal may cause a backlash for kids who truly need the help. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, yesterday, three more parents pleaded guilty in the college admissions cheating scandal. We're going to look into one aspect of this scandal, the ability of wealthy parents to get a learning disability diagnosis for their children. And that gives them permission to take more time on standardized tests like the ACT or SAT. Most kids who get these diagnoses have legitimate learning disabilities like dyslexia or ADD. It is easier, though, for well-off and well-connected parents to navigate the process, the system, to get that diagnosis. Now, because of the fallout from the admissions cheating scandal, some disability rights advocates fear there will be a negative fallout for the kids who need extra help. Joining us to talk about this are two experts, Lindsay Jones. She's the president of the National Center for Learning Disability. That's a nonprofit that advocates for students with disabilities. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Adita Janeja, she has a disability and she wrote an op-ed in Vox recently about her own experience navigating the education system. Hi there.
Hi.
Okay, so Lindsay, let's begin with you. Let's talk about what disabilities we're talking about in connection to taking extra time on standardized tests. What disabilities are covered in that?
Well, all disabilities are covered and can get accommodations under the law, but the bulk of students who receive accommodations on these types of tests have what we call a specific learning disability, which can be something like a reading, writing, math, or attention disability. These are brain-based disabilities that often involve processing in the brain of information.
And so then how would you go about getting a dispensation to have extra time on the ACT or the SAT?
an individual, a parent, or a guidance counselor has to appeal or not appeal, they have to apply for these accommodations. To do that, they have to provide information that the companies deem demonstrates that an individual has a disability. Typically, children are found eligible by their school system. If they're in a public school system, there is a process in place under the law where they're evaluated and then determined whether they're eligible for services in that school, then go through a process to apply for these accommodations with the testing companies directly.
Okay, so it's kind of a long and involved process, right? You can't just walk in and say, you know what, I have this thing, I need extra time.
Absolutely. In most cases, it's very long. And most students that we talk to actually have to appeal or provide lengthy amounts of information about their disability to receive the accommodations on the test.
And Aditi, was that the situation with you? How did you, if you got a special extra time for taking tests, how did you do it?
So I only even attempted to do this once. I did this in middle school when my tremor from my epilepsy was quite bad and I was having a hard time writing. And I requested an accommodation through my school for a standardized test that was conducted by the state. And I got a note from my neurologist explaining that I had epilepsy, which causes a tremor. And I had had many seizures at school. And so I think people, I think it was well known and well documented. But that was the only time that I ever requested an accommodation, precisely because of how long and involved and complicated this process was. I didn't use accommodations through most of my academic career through high school and college. So by the time I got to law school and was thinking about taking the bar exam, I knew I didn't have a documented history of using accommodations. And that in and of itself deterred me from even seeking accommodations, both for the bar exam and the LSAT. And the LSAT I really struggled to take with my epilepsy.
Right. So how common is it, Lindsay, for that to happen, that it's just really, really difficult and that someone just gives up and says, OK, I'll just try to soldier through?
You know, it makes me so sad to hear that. I'm so excited that you you have gone to law school and completed, and you're obviously really successful. But I just think it makes me sad that you had to even worry about it. And it happens more often than you would think. These are brain-based disabilities. Epilepsy is a brain-based disability. And these are things that federal law clearly provides these accommodations for. And all they do is really they level the playing field. Their intent is to make the environment for the person with a disability just the same as the person who's taking that test without the disability. It's very upsetting to hear how long it took, and I unfortunately hear that story too often.
A great example in terms of what it means to level the playing field. When I was taking the LSAT, the logic game portion of the LSAT used to trigger petit mal seizures for me, which are small seizures, which means I would go in and out of consciousness after doing three or four of those games. And part of my practice in studying to take the LSAT was learning to try to regulate my brain, trying to breathe and slow down. And so I learned to do those games faster than most people so that I would be able to take mental breaks in between. And I ended up scoring very well, but it was not a level playing field. I had to work faster so that I could regulate my brain in between. And I was fortunate. I figured out a hack that allowed me to do that. But epilepsy is unpredictable. People have different triggers, have different challenges with it. And for something that doesn't come and go like a seizure, but something that is more fixed like dyslexia or ADD or ADHD, they're not quite the same ways to manage it. And I had access to healthcare. I had a diagnosis. Lots of people go undiagnosed for a very long time because of lack of access to healthcare. So you can see how disadvantages and privileges layer on top of one another in this process.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the way the description of going through the system, Lindsay, you have to really understand how it works. And you have to, for example, speak English really well and have access to healthcare, as Aditi mentioned, but also know that you can go in and advocate for your child and then advocate again if she's rejected or he's rejected the first time. I mean, it seems like it's really advantageous to have built-in advantages, whether it be wealth or education or social class.
Yeah, I don't think you can overstate it. It's a very challenging process. I mean, even just a great point you just raised, being able to speak English. One of the things that's so challenging about the process for parents is that the law is quite prescriptive, which is good in that it's giving them lots of rights, but it also leads to the use of many technical words in educational settings, things like free appropriate public education. Even the wealthiest parents, the most educated parents, have conversations with me about their first meetings with the school where they can't even understand what's being told to them in the meeting because there's so much legal jargon. So you can imagine for someone who doesn't have English as a native language, who doesn't have the means or the resources, or who themselves also might have learning disabilities. So there are many barriers that are in place, and it clearly is a system where, like many systems, having resources and having advantage can give you an incredible leg up.
So do you see more kids in wealthier and whiter schools having more of these diagnoses?
So that's a really complicated question. We would expect across every either racial or ethnic group that we'd have the same level of amounts of disability anywhere. By and large, that's true, except we know that actually in our environments, in our inner cities, in areas with less resources, we do see high numbers of children with disabilities that are identified by their public schools. Some of the reason for that, many of our researchers have posited, is because there are other environmental factors at play there, trauma, stress, and poverty, that might be things that the school is identifying and that aren't actually a disability, but that are causing learning issues or behavior issues in the classroom. And school staff is calling them a disability to get them extra services. So this is a really complicated issue.
Yeah. So Aditi, I don't know if you can talk about your experience and then the experience of your peers. I don't know where you went to high school, but was this something that was talked about? Was it common, or was it something kind of hidden where kids would be ashamed to get a diagnosis for a learning disability?
So the reason that I only used accommodations once in middle school was because I was ashamed to use accommodations for a test. I was in a mainstream classroom. I wasn't doing special education. But when I took the test with accommodations, I was put in a classroom with students whose disabilities, in my vantage point, were more severe than mine. And it made me feel bad about myself because I had this internalized ableism. But that internalized feeling that I was somehow less smart because I was using an accommodation caused me not to seek one for the rest of my academic and professional career.
Well, so this gets us back to the college admissions cheating scandal. And looking at the affidavit, we have the main guy, the alleged main guy, Rick Singer, saying to a client, "We need to get your daughter tested for a learning difference. If she gets tested for a learning difference, and let's say it's my person that does it or whoever you want to do it, I need that person to get her 100% extended time over multiple days." I mean, he's talking about gaming the system, getting a sympathetic therapist to write a note, and that extended time process happening. And Lindsay, I guess, what does that raise for you? I mean, obviously that is not legal, but there are things that are legal that might kind of skirt the edges of that, where maybe a kid could take a test without an extended time, but, you know, says, "Oh, I have problems focusing in class. I can't concentrate. I might have ADD," and then that kid can get a diagnosis.
You know, one of the things that Aditi just pointed out is, I think it's pretty rare that students want to be segregated, want to be labeled with a disability. That now, as she said, I think there's a history of ableism there that we need to fight against. There's nothing wrong with learning differences, and we need to start focusing on children's strengths and everyone's strengths. But I think the idea that there's also no evidence to suggest that any person who simply has more time to take a test does better. The longer you stare at the page, if you don't know the answer, it won't necessarily come to you in the extra time you have. It's also really important to point out, he did that because he controlled the testing location. Mm-hmm. So young people went to a site where another person came in and changed all their answers. The average student in our nation goes to their local public high school or a testing site run by their guidance counselor. So it's not typically an environment that's as open to this type of cheating.
Are you afraid, though, that the fallout from this, you know, the fact that this is such big news, will have negative repercussions on students who really need extra time to take the test and need a diagnosis?
Yes, absolutely. I think that could be possibly the worst outcome. There are so many hoops that someone with a disability already goes through. As Aditi mentioned, the world is a disabling condition. That it is not universally designed for everyone. And so this, if the response here is to make it even harder to prove that you need the accommodation, that the accommodation is real, and really it ultimately that your disability is real. The idea that making individuals have to continually prove they have a disability and making it harder for them to prove how their understanding, their persistence, and their ability to succeed would be the worst outcome possible.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Lindsay Jones is president of the National Center for Learning Disability, and Aditi Janeja is a lawyer and activist. Coming up, how the tuberculosis scare in the 19th century influenced modern 20th century architecture.
Large windows would allow more healing sunlight to come into the patients, and all the whiteness was the better to see dirt. It had these very practical implications at the beginning. And then, of course, it evolved into markers of luxury.
How California became a symbol of clean living. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. California is known as the capital of health and wellness fads. Celery juice, goat yoga, avocado toast, goop. But when and how did we get that reputation? Lyra Kilston explores that in her new book. It's called Sun Seekers, The Cure of California. And she argues that it all began a long time ago in the 19th century when tuberculosis was raging. Lyra Kilston joins me now. Hi.
Hi.
TB, huh? TB was the origins of this?
Yes. Well, it was such a scourge, and people were really scrambling to find a cure, and doctors really had no idea what to do. And at the time, in the late 19th century, the idea of a climate cure became very popular. There was an idea that the lungs needed to be dried out and warmed up. And so if you were living in a cold and snowy place like Boston or New York, doctors sometimes would advise you to literally move to a drier and more arid climate so that you would be healed.
Is there anything to that? Is tuberculosis curable in that way?
Not so much about the dryness, but there has been scientific evidence that exposure to vitamin D in sunlight can help the body fight disease.
Hmm.
So they were onto something.
But it became a fad. It became a way to sell California too, right? Like,
yes.
There was this slogan, California is the sanatorium of the world.
Yes. Well, people were really interested in getting, populating the cities, especially Southern California. You know, you had the gold rush and that was really populating San Francisco, but in Southern California, besides agriculture, they really wanted to grow as a city. And from the very beginning, there were boosters that were talking not only about the fantastic weather for entrepreneurs and agricultural people, but also for health. And it became quite a lure for people to come out.
All right. But you're saying, and what was I found extremely fascinating in your book, Sunseekers, is you have a whole section on architecture. And of course, California, modern architecture, modernism in architecture started here in California,
mm-hmm.
In Southern California with Richard Neutra and Rudolf Schindler, you know, as acolytes of Frank Lloyd Wright. And that their architecture intimately ties in with this idea of health and of curing tuberculosis.
Yes, sort of tangentially. I mean, For example, Neutra was in Europe for about 10 years longer than Schindler was. So he was exposed to a lot of the trends that were happening in Europe at the time, in which sanatoriums that were being built outside of cities were slowly evolving to incorporate the ideas about natural cures and exposure to healing, fresh air and sunlight. So it was the ideas about medicine were changing architecture in Europe at the time. So Neutra was exposed to some of that. So when he came out to California, he knew what was happening in European modernism.
You have a quote in your book by Le Corbusier, the famous modernist mm-hmm. architect. He says, "The machine that we live in is an old coach full of tuberculosis, whereas the modern house is a health machine for living."
Right. So housing and city design was very much blamed for the outbreak of tuberculosis. I mean, of course, humans had been dealing with various plagues over the centuries, but in the 19th century, when so many of them flocked to cities for the Industrial Revolution, they were living closer together than they ever had before. So there was a way that disease spread like it had never mm-hmm. done before. This was seen as a public health crisis, and there were healthy building committees that were started in, you know, like Liverpool, for example, where they realized that the number of people who had tuberculosis was much higher in certain kinds of housing. So the design of housing and the design of cities became a public health concern. And doctors and architects began working together in tandem in a way that I don't know has happened. I don't know if that's happened since at the same level.
So the idea of this white cube, this modernist white cube with lots of windows, that is evoking like a clinic, like a hospital, like a clean, disease-free place
right.
to live?
Yes. So the large windows would allow more healing sunlight to come into the patients. And all the whiteness was the better to see dirt. It had these very practical implications at the beginning. And then, of course, it evolved into, you know, markers of luxury.
So enter Rudolf Schindler
mm-hmm.
and Richard Neutra, two of the pillars of modern architecture based here in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And how did all of this health consciousness factor into their designs?
Well, for the most part, it had to do with the fact that they both were commissioned by the same patron, who was this eccentric naturopathic doctor named Philip Lovell. And he had a column in the Los Angeles Times for most of the 1920s called Care of the Body. And he had very strong opinions about a raw vegetarian diet and regular nude sunbathing. And he was against any kind of drug from a conventional doctor. And he had enough patients that his business did very well. And he was able to commission not one, but I think a total of four houses from these architects, who, of course, we know them as giants, but in his time, they were fresh, young architects that were desperate for a job. So together, it was quite an amazing relationship. And first, Lovell, before Neutra even came to Los Angeles, he and Schindler worked together on three different vacation houses, one of which is the Newport Beach house, which is still standing. And together, they incorporated some of Lovell's desire for things like sleeping porches and areas for nude sunbathing, and, you know, the really prioritizing things like having fresh air flow through and enabling everyone in the family to reap all of nature's elements.
And the nude sunbathing. I know there was a lot of free love going on. I mean, they were sort of the original hippies, I guess, or at least Schindler was.
Right. Yes.
Not Neutra so much, but he's a little more buttoned up.
Yes,
wore a tie a lot. Schindler never wore a tie. Right? But anyway, that was a health issue, right? They thought, oh, well, you need to have your body exposed to the sun for all these health reasons.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean,
it wasn't just...
Right. It didn't really have to do with like being a libertine at all. Mm-hmm. It was really about health. And there were doctors that prescribed sun exposure, you know, exposing your body a few more inches every day in this like very regimented way. And it was seen similar to the way that we would take vitamins today.
Hmm. I see. Okay. So a little bit more about Lovell, because he is a sort of a California character in that he reinvents himself. That's not his original name.
Right. Yes. He was born Morris Saperstein in New York. And he left New York and came west, and he got a sort of dubious chiropractic naturopathic degree somewhere in the Midwest, and came out here, and he decided to change his name to...
Because it sounded too Jewish?
I mean, probably. He doesn't say that, but yes, probably. So he chose this very palatable Philip Lovell, and he opened a practice in downtown. And one of his very first clients was Harry Chandler of the Los Angeles Times, who himself had come out to Los Angeles because he had tuberculosis. Hmm. And so he got better out here, but he remained enthralled to any kind of alternative healing idea.
So he hires Neutra to create what was Neutra's career-defining house, the Lovell House.
Yes.
And actually redefined modern architecture, that house, didn't it? It was the first steel-framed home.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
And it's still standing today in Los Feliz.
Yes, it is.
Although under a little bit decayed, but...
Yeah.
And
it's
so...
It's not as healthy as it once was.
No. But it had all of those elements, right? The sun porches.
Oh, yeah. It had... It was... So it had a swimming pool for exercise, but absolutely no chlorine because he thought that was this horrible drug. And so he had this... He devised a system where... every so often the pool water would be drained, and then he could use that to water his hundreds of avocado trees that he planted on the hillside. And there was a bunch of gym equipment for his kids and an outdoor classroom where his wife could teach them. And every single bedroom, I mean, it was a bedroom, but it was really just a small room that led out onto a screened sleeping porch, because that's where you were supposed to sleep in all weather. And yes, the nude sunbathing areas, and then a special kitchen that was designed for the preparation of vegetarian and usually raw food.
And what year is this?
1929.
That's incredible.
Yes.
Because these ideas are now, well, they're not even mainstream now.
No, right.
But at the time, people probably thought they were crazy.
Yes. And because he had this very popular column in the Los Angeles Times, he invited his readers to an open house in December 1929, and Neutra was there to greet them as well and kind of explain his ideas. And I think, and it was very popular, thousands of people drove up the hill to see it. And I think for the most part, I think the majority of them came because they thought it would just be the weirdest and wackiest thing they'd ever seen.
And maybe it was.
Yes.
Because at the time, the prevailing architecture was kind of a Spanish style imitation, right?
With yes.
The thick walls, the adobe tile.
Right. Or, I mean, any kind of, you know, Danish thing or whatever. Whatever people wanted to import that they had been comfortable with on the East Coast mm-hmm. was what most of the architecture was.
So it wasn't, your book is not just about them. It's our architecture, although that's a good chunk of it. It's also about raw foodism as well and other health fads that have now become more mainstream. And so it's interesting that people would come out here for health reasons and especially for lung reasons, to clear up their lungs. And now at Los Angeles is, well, has the most pollution
yeah.
of any American city. So and yet we still cling to this idea that this is a place for rejuvenation, for good health, for healthy living.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of ironies wrapped up in it. And I think that people still do come out. And, you know, like, yes, we do have the worst air, but we also have these incredible wild places that right within the city, that's quite unusual. And we have access to natural places very easily, of course, by car. So mm-hmm. it's a very sort of ironic situation.
Right. And yet, I think, you know, people still pursue various health fads. I mean, we still talk about the...
Endlessly.
Yeah.
Endlessly.
The juicing and the cleansing.
Yes.
And the avocadoing.
Yes. And the cryogenics.
Yeah. Goes on and on. The book is called Sun Seekers, The Cure of California by Lyra Kilston. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're going to talk about more details on one of the houses central to California modernism, the Lovell House. We talked a little bit about it with Lyra. We're going to talk about what it looks like today next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, you heard Lyra Kilston mention the Lovell Health House. It's at the edge of Griffith Park in Los Feliz, built back in 1929. The Austrian immigrant architect Richard Neutra designed it for a doctor, a naturopath named Dr. Philip Lovell. KCRW's Frances Anderton recently took a tour of the house as it exists today. She's here now. Hi.
Hello, Madeline.
Okay, so this was built in 1929, very, very long time ago.
That's right.
Has it been kept up?
Well, not to perfection. And also, it's been thoroughly surrounded. You know, imagine back then it was really in the wilds and thousands of people came to see it and were just stunned by this kind of machine that had sprung up from the landscape. Now you wind through plenty of houses that have really thoroughly surrounded it and you get to stairs at the top that lead you down into, yes, indeed, still a relatively white orthogonal building projecting out of the land. But sadly, you know, not as crisp and clean as some of the other iconic mid-century buildings of Los Angeles that have been so well looked after. This is a house that has been lived in. It's
yes.
in fact been lived
in. Well, that's
in.
A good thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. It's actually kind of amazing to see how lived in it is. A family called the Toppers bought the house back in 1960. Mr. Topper himself used to play with the Lovell boys and had known the house. Mm. The Toppers have lived there ever since. There were already some changes that had been made to the house, such as things like enclosing the famed sleeping porches where you had the nude sunbathing. Some of those changes had already been made because the house was somewhat petite. That gave it more space.
By the Lovells themselves?
Apparently, a preservationist we spoke with thought that this was the Lovells themselves. There were owners in the interim. Since the Toppers have lived there, they haven't gone in for sort of routine repairs. So the house is looking a little bit, I suppose one might say, down at heel. You know, the stucco is not so sparkly white. The paint is peeling. There's a marvellous pool that was, you know, once glittering blue and is now empty and dry. So the roof leaks. The last paint job apparently was done actually before the making of LA Confidential, which was made at the house. That came out in 1997. So there's some sort of routine repairs as well as some fundamental repairs that are yet to be done.
So you talked to some preservationists or some people who are aficionados of modern architecture when you went on your tour.
Obsessives, I would say.
Oh, okay. More than aficionados.
I would say you may yourself have met folks in the preservation community who are so utterly passionate about buildings that there's a sense of ownership even when they don't actually own the building.
Yes, I've had that experience.
And yeah, I did meet a gathering of great people who just are really concerned about making sure that the Lovell Health House is preserved into perpetuity. One of those folks is a guy called George Smart. He's host of the podcast US Modernist Radio. He actually talks about the novel experience of the building as it was. Let's just hear from him.
You've got these great windows that bring in the sun, and you can open them up, and you can bring in the breeze, and then you can go to different levels in the house for different experiences based on time of day. There's a lovely aquamarine pool on the outside that you can swim in if you want to. It's pretty fabulous.
As I said, in fact, the pool doesn't have any water in it right now, but obviously there's a dream that will be restored. And as I said, the Topper family's there. Mr. Topper passed away. Betty Topper still lives there. She's in her 90s. Mm-hmm. And her son, Ken. And then now living with them is a new renter called Josh Gorell. Josh is one of the many aficionados of the building that is sort of quite, you know, protective of its future. And he's actually taken a space right by this pool. And he is very, very keen that that someone might step forward or some institution might step forward and make it possible to restore the house to its former glory. And here he is.
The right person really needs to open their heart to the house and to Neutra and to architecture first, and then open their pocketbooks to the restoration second, and really allow it to breathe and become something that no one's ever seen before. And that would be truly special.
And the thing that folks like Josh Goel, and in fact most of us should be concerned about, is the notion of somebody coming in, purchasing the property, tearing it down and replacing it with something else. Yeah. And I think that would be very difficult because the house does have a landmark status. But as Josh points out, this was a relatively petite house for the now exceedingly affluent area that it is in. And so the idea of getting people to sort of strip it back is something that is definitely for people who are utterly devoted to the building.
So would he, I guess he wouldn't have a say because he's just a tenant, but would the owner, the Toppers, would they be able to put in any kind of buying agreement, stipulation that someone couldn't ruin it?
First of all, I'll say Josh is actually himself a preservationist. So I think that definitely he's harboring a hope that.
But he wouldn't have any power because he's not going to buy it.
No. I mean, it depends on, I suppose, who buys it. This thing about stipulating is really interesting. Let's see, this came up with the Ray Bradbury house when that was sold, actually, by the three daughters who sold it to Tom Main and his wife Blythe, the architects, and they have put a marvelous house in its place. And at the time, there was a discussion about, you know, should the daughters have put in some kind of stipulation? They didn't. I personally don't know the law on these kind of things. I presume the Toppers could try. I mean, this, as you said to Lyra, I heard you say, this is a remarkable, iconic, incredibly important house. So, of course, I think all of us as Angelenos would hope that it can be preserved. Mm.
And it's not officially for sale.
It's not officially for sale, but we were told by Ken Topper, the son, that if someone knocks on the door with the right offer, they'd be open to offers.
Okay. Very clear. Right. Thank you, Frances Anderton. She is host of KCRW's Design and Architecture. Thank you for talking about the Lovell Health House with us today.
A pleasure, Madeline. Thank you.
All right. And that'll do it for us here at Press Play. Don't forget, you can subscribe to our podcast. It's for free. Go to iTunes. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.